Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
It's Friday at last of one of the most momentous weeks we've seen in Cleveland. We'll be talking a little bit about that on Today in Ohio, the news podcast discussion from Cleveland.com and The Plain Dealer. I'm Chris Quinn here with Lisa Garvin, Laura Johnston, and Layla Tassi. And we're starting with HB6, the death by apparent suicide of Sam Randazzo, the former utilities chief who was facing criminal charges in two courts, has an impact on the other defendants charged in the massive First Energy bribery case. Jake Zuckerman talked to experts on what could happen next in those cases. Lisa, what did he find?
And there are various charges against Sam Randazzo that are, all of them are kind of uncertain at this point. There's first the 11-count federal indictment over the HB6 scandal. There's also the state indictment where Randazzo was indicted along with First Energy CEO Chuck Jones and lobbyist Mike Dowling. There's also the Attorney General's civil case that froze millions in Randazzo's assets. And then there's the First Energy investor lawsuit over that $4.3 million bribe to Randazzo. So Ohio's Southern District U.S. Attorney Ken Parker says there's no comment on the Randazzo death. There's no formal motion to drop the indictments against him as of yet. But we also talked to former U.S. Attorney David DeVillers, who was in office when HB6 charges were brought. He says the charges will probably be dropped, and he said that statements to investigators will no longer have value. They might still be able to go after Randazzo's assets, but he says federal charges against Jones and Dowling seem unlikely at this point. There's something called the Petit Principle. Federal prosecutors must follow Department of Justice policy that bars prosecution if the state has reached a decision on the merits of the case. Attorney General Dave Yost says this will not affect his state case. He says we're not dismissing any charges or defendants. And this case also includes two businesses that were owned and operated by Randazzo. Yost says the frozen assets case has been stayed right now by a Franklin County Common Pleas judge who said it was necessary to protect Randazzo's Fifth Amendment rights, but they're not sure if his death is going to change the situation over his assets. Randazzo's attorney, Richard Blake, told the Columbus Dispatch that he's been tarred and feathered in the media by prosecutors before the opportunity to address the charges.
He's been tarred and feathered by First Energy saying, yes, we bribed him. It's kind of hard to claim innocence when the payer of the bribe said, yes, those millions of dollars we gave him, they were bribes. The evidence against this guy was overwhelming. That's what tarred and feathered him. It was his actions that tarred and feathered him. It's ridiculous to once again attack the messenger. Shame on his attorney for doing that. I was a little bit surprised at the idea that this could impact the Chuck Jones prosecution, because Sam Randazzo had not turned state's evidence. Mm-hmm. So their case against him has nothing to do with anything Sam Randazzo said. So that seems bogus to me. I mean, it seems like those cases need to move ahead. First Energy has already pleaded guilty paying bribes. These were the guys making the decisions for that company. The evidence is pretty strong. Why on earth would they let them go? I hope this isn't some dodge to let the rich, wealthy guys who fund the bribery go free.
Well, you know, and we've been concerned about that, the lack of federal indictments after all of this. And then that's why Attorney General Yost stepped in. And actually, he looks like, you know, pretty prescient right now. He's going to continue to go after them. But yeah, I find that troubling that they won't go after them on a, likely won't go after them on a federal level.
Well, Dave DeVillers, when he was the U.S. attorney, he was doing it. He was the one that pushed this case. He was moving with alacrity. It was all going well. When Biden got elected and he got the boot, the new guy, he just doesn't move. I don't know what is going on and why he has so slowed this process. But with the Randazzo case out of the way, he ought to be looking at the payers of the bribes. The other thing is the money. I mean, if this is ill-gotten gains, which is what Dave Yost has claimed from the beginning, I don't think the family gets to keep it just because the guy who got the ill-gotten gains dies. I think you've got to get the money back. That money belongs to the ratepayers of Ohio.
And I think Yost will not stop until he gets it back. There is that stay, well, but yeah.
Well, and let's look, let's think about it too. Yost is running for governor. John Husted is running for governor. And there are lots of people wondering how close does this case get to John Husted or even Mike DeWine. Dave Yost isn't going to let that go. You're listening to Today in Ohio. ATF Chief Steve Dettelbach, the former U.S. attorney in Cleveland, has an idea for finally closing the gun show loophole that has funneled uncountable guns into the streets outside of the normal background check process that puts some rigor around the purchase process. Layla, what does he propose to do?
Dettelbach plans to apply new standards for the type of firearm sales that will require federal licensure. And that will mean, as you said, Chris, closing the gun show loophole that's let thousands of unlicensed gun dealers sell tens of thousands of guns without background checks. That practice has put so many guns in the hands of felons, in the hands of domestic abusers, and sometimes kids. And it's just led to a great deal of tragedy. Both Vice President Kamala Harris and Attorney General Merrick Garland applauded this move from, for blocking a flood of illegal guns from hitting our communities. And this new rule is a result of 2022's bipartisan Safer Communities Act. And it basically says that regardless of whether guns are sold on the internet, at a gun show, or at a brick and mortar store, if you sell guns predominantly to earn a profit, you have to be licensed and you must conduct background checks. There are currently about 80,000 licensed gun dealers in the U.S., and senior White House officials estimate that the new rule will require around 23,000 unlicensed gun dealers to get licenses, and that'll affect tens of thousands of gun sales each year. And those sales without a background check account for about 22% of gun sales in America. So this is a huge deal and long overdue.
Yeah. What's funny, too, is the NRA and the gun people immediately came out and said this is a Second Amendment violation. And often they're able to stop laws, but I don't see how they can do it here because these background check laws have been upheld at gun shops. All you're doing is expanding it to other merchants. And look, we've all seen over the years, the gun shows are the Wild West. If you see military kind of rifles changing hands with no idea whether the people who are buying them should be able to buy them. It's sad that it's taken this long to close this loophole, but my bet is this one will withstand the court challenges. I don't see the U.S. Supreme Court parsing the kind of seller. If you can force background checks in gun shops, you can enforce them with anybody who sells any kind of number of guns. So it's a good thing. It's good to see. And it's a Northeast Ohio story because, as we know, at the county fairgrounds, how often do they have gun shows?
Yeah, right. Has anyone else? I've been to a gun show at the county fairgrounds. Anyone else on this podcast attended one?
No.
I went for a story. I mean, I didn't go for pleasure, I'll tell you that. But I mean, they're like flea markets for guns. Mm-hmm. There's folding tables with guns. You're out the door with your purchase in minutes. Mm-hmm. I mean, just paper receipt, you're gone with, like you said, assault rifles. And people are selling guns off the back of their trucks at some of these things. It's like the Wild West. You're right, Chris. And it's I'm pleased to see this. I do wonder what enforcement will be like and whether they'll actually, you know, how will someone be dispatched to make sure that these are being done, you know, done with background checks from now on.
It just never made sense that you had all this rigor. If you go into a Dick's or, well, I don't know if they sell guns anymore, but you know, Fin Feather and Fur to buy a gun, they check out who you are. They do a quick criminal check. You know, there's rigor there to make sure that felons aren't getting guns. Yet 22% of the guns sold is like, hey, you want a gun? Here, give me money. Cash deal. Go away. Nobody, no record, no idea who it is, no idea if they're entitled. And the NRA and all the Second Amendment crazies kept saying, that's legitimate, that's legitimate. It's not legitimate. And finally, good for Steve Dettelbach. You're listening to Today in Ohio. Ohio Governor Mike DeWine wants more people wearing seatbelts, but lawmakers don't much like his methods. Laura, where's the disagreement?
It's over personal freedom. They basically say we can't make this a primary offense because obviously it's been against the law for a very long time. to not wear a seatbelt, but you can't get pulled over for that offense in Ohio. You can only get cited if you're pulled over for something else. But he said this, DeWine brought it up in his State of the State address on Wednesday. This is the second year in a row he's brought it up and wanted to get it done. But the legislators made it go away last year, and they could this year as well. President Matt Huffman from the Ohio Senate, he said his concept is personal freedom. Some of it is that the folks who tend to get those tickets, those folks that are stopped the most, are the people least able to pay the bill, which it sounds like a very empathetic statement from Matt Huffman. I don't know if he's just throwing it out there.
When you say personal freedom, they're saying you have a personal freedom to disobey the existing law. Now, why can't then I apply that to anything? You know, I mean, there is a law in the books that says you must wear a seatbelt. Mm-hmm. So you do not have the personal freedom not to wear a seatbelt. It's the law. Mike DeWine is just saying, I want to make it a primary offense because I want more people pulled over.
Right.
Now, if they wanted to say, we don't want to do this because we think police would use it to profile, or we think this could be too easily abused, we like it the way it is, okay, fine. But you can't say it's personal freedom. None of us have the personal freedom to choose which laws we obey. You obey all the laws. I was staggered by this. Mm-hmm. It's personal freedom. If you don't want to wear a seatbelt, you don't have to wear a seatbelt. Yeah, actually, you do. It's the law.
And you, right. You have the personal freedom to fly through the windshield when you get into an accident.
I mean, I would say most of us break the speeding law, but that's something that you can get pulled over for. That's a primary offense. And apparently this is a problem. I mean, I always wear my seatbelt. I can't imagine driving without it. But we talked earlier in this week how Cleveland police have been handing out more citations for seatbelt violations this year. That's increased by nearly 9%. And between 2013 and 2023, an average of 476 Ohioans were not wearing seatbelts. They died in fatal crashes every year. That's a whole lot of people. And as fancy as the things that we have on our cars now, you know, where it won't let you change lanes without your turn signal and the anti-lock brakes and all of those wonderful things, seatbelts are much more effective at protecting you in a crash. And yeah, unbelted deaths are 64% of all traffic fatalities.
Mm-hmm. I do think if the police had this tool, they would use it unfairly to target certain populations. They have a long history of doing that. We've been arguing for some years now that police should not be allowed to chase mm-hmm. anybody for minor offenses where they get the license plate number and things, because it leads to horrible things. And giving the police another kind of bogus reason to say, I don't see the seatbelt on that guy, I'm going to pull him over, it'll be abused. And do we really want to get into that situation? I actually don't agree with Mike DeWine on this, and I think they ought to leave it the way it is. But it's not because I have the personal right, the personal freedom to just decide not to follow the law, except the speed limit law, because everybody knows that's not real.
Well, I do want to bring up that apparently the youngest drivers have the lowest rate of wearing seatbelts, and the national average is 91%. Ohio's at 81%. So I completely agree with you, Chris. I see where this could be abused. Let's start a national. I mean, we already have the click it or ticket, right? But let's come up with another campaign. Let's do something to tell people how much more protected they are in a car if they wear seatbelts. So the youngest drivers who might be fiddling with their, you know, cell phone rather than putting on their seatbelts know how serious this is, because we should be protecting our drivers.
Back in 1980, and this is way before there were seatbelt laws, I think it was the Wall Street Journal did a 5-part series on how seatbelts protect you. And I never drove again without wearing a seatbelt. It's the power of the media. Mm-hmm. That's what we need to do. We need to explain, this is what happens if you don't, this is what happens if you do, because there's no doubt that wearing a seatbelt protects people in ways that can save their lives, save their ability to thrive. But, you know, we've all been wearing them so long. When's the last time somebody did that kind of work? Here's what happens when you don't wear a seatbelt. I think the publicity campaign would do more than anything. You're listening to Today in Ohio. Reporter Mark Bono looked back over the Cleveland week like no other. How did Cleveland do, Lisa, and what are the long-term ramifications?
Yeah, Mark talked to a couple of people who are, you know, proponents of the tourism industry in Cleveland. David Gilbert, who's the president and CEO of Destination Cleveland and the Greater Cleveland Sports Commission, he said that, you know, they knew that the Final Four was going to bring sold out crowds and many related events, and they knew that visitors would spend money while they're in Cleveland. That just happens in a city that hosts a Final Four. But he said it was so much more than that, and it was a whole nother level than last year's Final Four in Dallas. He said the media exposure was off the charts. Part of that because of Caitlin Clark's historic drive. There were a bunch of women-centric groups and sports organizations that came to Cleveland and had events. And then with the eclipse at the same time, it was just a 1-2 punch. He said there were lots of all the network morning shows did live shots from Cleveland. They were saying great things about our city. And he said it was just beyond our best imagination. Now, previous studies said that the economic impact of a Final Four would have been about $22 million, but he thinks it could be $30 million or more. And we also talked to Destination Cleveland board member and Market Garden Brewery co-owner Sam McNulty. He said he had friends in Austin, Texas, who were texting him pics of clouds and rain for the eclipse in Texas, because everyone went to Texas thinking the weather would be great. And he said he texted back blue sky pics and said, take that. He saw a lot of out-of-state license plates and heard a lot of foreign accents at his brewery. And he said their special Totality beer sold like hotcakes.
Yeah, Sam's a great representative of Cleveland. Everybody's still talking about the eclipse. And we've done a favor to our readers. We normally sell photos for $75, but because people are so interested in getting that great shot that Dave Pekowitz took of Tower City with the eclipse and some of the others, we're selling them for $20. We'll send you a high-res image that you could take and get printed out so you have this memory on your wall. And we keep hearing from people. I actually got a note overnight for that sequence I put up, so that was the first time I think I've ever sold a photo in my life. You are listening to Today in Ohio. We've talked a lot in the past couple of years about the Jane Edna Hunter Building, the office building for health and human service workers that has been a makeshift shelter for kids with no place to go. County Executive Chris Ronayne has big plans for ending that problem. Layla, when can we expect that building to close?
The expectation is that this is going to happen within the next 3 years. This week, they presented a timeline for the county's plan for moving the Health and Human Services Department staff into our old headquarters at 1801 Superior Avenue, along with the Board of Elections. And that means that they're going to try to sell off the Jane Edna Hunter Health and Human Services office building. As for the kids who would frequently be dropped off at Jane Edna when they have nowhere else to go and end up sleeping on cots in the office building and eating Pop-Tarts for days on end, the county will be investing in a child wellness campus that could both humanely house kids and provide them with social services. So far, the county has set aside $10.8 million to reserve 8 emergency beds at the Cleveland Christian Home, but that hasn't been enough to meet the demand. So the county is planning to build out more of the space, turning it into a full child wellness campus, and that can take kids while they're awaiting placement in foster care, for example. And that campus, they say, will house up to 58 kids, and they want to have it fully operational by 2027.
I appreciate that Chris Ronayne took this seriously. It took a little longer than we would have liked, but he took it seriously. He's got very substantial plans for fixing this. Our reporter, Caitlin Durbin, had done a lot of work to demonstrate this problem, and it is going to be fixed. It's pretty cool. You're listening to Today in Ohio. National media have had plenty of stories this year about how China has been cornering the world market for electronic vehicles, which they sell for prices far lower than anything you can get in the U.S. They are a top China export. Sherrod Brown is taking notice. What does he want to do about it, Laura?
He doesn't want the Chinese to be able to sell cars to Americans because that manufacturing is subsidized by the Chinese government. That's what makes it so cheap. And he doesn't want them to take over the market share and put any American automakers out of business. So he sent a letter to President Biden warning about these subsidies. And we know that the cars are not sold here now. He wants to keep it that way. He says in Europe, they're taking over the market. Nearly 20% of all electric vehicles sold in Europe were built in China. And that is a strong warning for what could happen to the United States. He's also saying, hey, if we get these cars here, we don't know what kind of information the Chinese government could be collecting about Americans. It's kind of the same thing about TikTok. So he's saying, don't let them come here, protect our people and our businesses.
I've read a lot about this. And yeah, there's some subsidies, but they are making them cheaper. They have figured out a way to mass produce these at a much lower price than Detroit can. And by not letting Americans have those, they're making it a financial hardship on America. They're selling a lot in Europe because they are very inexpensive. Yeah. His idea that they could collect data, you would think that the U.S. could take a look at these cars and see if they're secretly transmitting something. I mean, it's not that hard to measure. But by stopping their entry into Cleveland, you are creating a non-competitive market and kind of jacking Americans on price. This is a non-competitive move that I'm a little bit surprised by.
Yeah, Sherrod's always been the big protector of the American manufacturing economy. So it doesn't surprise me that he's taking this stance. But you're right, these are less than $10,000. And when you think about how much a new car costs, I mean, it's staggering. So that you could buy an electric vehicle to get you around, and maybe it's not, they're small, right? They're not the gigantic trucks or SUVs that a lot of Americans want. But maybe this is an instigator for Detroit to build that kind of vehicle.
Look, China has invested in this, and they're getting the payoff from it. You would think that Detroit would try and learn some lessons here, because the cost of EVs right now is prohibitive. And really, let's face it, the market for that isn't that big. People would prefer hybrids. You're listening to Today in Ohio. We have a direct flight from Cleveland to Jamaica now, but travel writer Susan Glaser said it might not last very long. Why not? And Lisa, what did Susan have to say about any fears of traveling in Jamaica where the U.S. is warning people to restrict travel?
Yeah, Frontier Airlines launched nonstop service to Jamaica back in January. It was Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and $400 round trip. And it was supposed to run through August, but they're reevaluating customer demand and the impact of the U.S. State Department's travel advisory, which in March said people should strongly reconsider going to Jamaica due to crime and lack of medical services. Now, Susan Glaser recently took that Frontier flight to Jamaica. It lands in Montego Bay, and she said that the flight was less than half full. There were about 35 people, and everyone got their own row on the plane, and it was the same coming back. She did talk to a flight attendant, and she said that their other Jamaica flight that goes from St. Louis to Montego Bay was also less than half full. So she didn't really say whether she felt unsafe while she was there, but travel experts are saying that people, you know, are reconsidering trips to Jamaica now.
And if they do, and there's less demand for the flight, they'll have to cancel the flight until things change. It's kind of sad. She's done a bunch of stories about traveling around Jamaica, but clearly people are going to heed the government's warnings.
And she said, you know, if you want to take advantage of that flight, you should probably do it sooner rather than later.
All right, you're listening to Today in Ohio. Cleveland Mayor Justin Bibb campaigned on modernizing City Hall, and he just rolled out a new data portal that actually does contain quite a bit of good information, easily accessed from your cell phone. It's not in any means complete yet. But Layla, what can people find there?
This is Justin Bibb really making good on a campaign promise to make City Hall more accessible to the public. In the portal, you'll find more than 50 data sets so far. They cover information related to health, housing, public safety, transit, infrastructure, stuff like that. There are interactive dashboards, graphs and charts and data stories that incorporate data and text to better explain a particular topic. So in the past, the city has made some city data public, but it lacked a lot of the context that would help residents find the information useful. This is really designed to improve upon that. And the city is saying it's pretty user-friendly and intuitive and accessible. But, you know, Courtney Astolfi took it for a little test spin yesterday, and she found that some of the portal's resources are really likely to be most useful in the hands of people who have some familiarity with how to analyze data. In some cases, the user really needs more context from City Hall to understand the information in the portal. For example, she said, you know, there's a 15-minute city index that attempts to show walkable access to amenities and services across the neighborhoods. But when the information is downloaded into an Excel spreadsheet, The only thing that comes up is a long list of numbers that appear impossible to decipher without a key or some other context that explains what they mean. But other data is easy to decipher and to use. And there are maps that show every city-owned parcel in Cleveland, for example, or the service areas of community development corporations that get taxpayer support. So I'm sure that we're going to find many storytelling opportunities in this trove of data, and I hope it is useful to residents. And it is a step in the right direction in terms of transparency. But, you know, my issue here is that the city is still pretty terrible at responding to public records requests. So it's still a gigantic headache to get what we need from City Hall when we need it. And if Justin Bibb really wants to improve upon transparency and accountability, I think he needs to start there.
Okay, but you do have to give him credit. He has begun to deliver on that promise. It's a first step. It's going to take a long time to get everything there. When death certificates and birth certificates are easily available, and much more so now, that'll be a big step. But you're not going to get there unless you take that first step. This is a pretty good first step. But like you said, there's a ways to go yet.
Yeah, I mean, this is the public-facing step, but if the public knew how hard it was to get information out of City Hall, I think that would, I don't know, that changes the narrative a bit.
You're listening to Today in Ohio. What is the Cleveland Clinic planning in its reimagined Fairview Hospital campus, Laura?
A whole bunch of possibilities here. $150 million construction project, a combined cancer center, a medical office building, and a new parking garage, which I think is the biggest sticking point when you're talking to the neighbors, because no one wants to live next to a parking garage. So the clinic cleared a bunch of space demolishing homes near the hospital. And they're going to be raising the two-story mall cancer center and a 700-space parking deck, all built in the 70s and 80s, and figuring out how to replace all this. And they've got five proposed building configurations for this campus project that they showed to residents. And if you're thinking about this area, it's Cam's Corners. It's like the opposite of a big open space. This is very tight quarters here. It's all built up. There's a shopping plaza there. There's residential. You've got the bridge over the Rocky River right on the other side of it. It doesn't have a lot of places to go. So they're trying to figure out the best place to put all of these buildings and to keep the residents happy. They do have the idea of some landscape green space, which all good for the clinic. I think we need more of that, which the neighbors were the most appreciative of.
Yeah, it's a big campus. It is something that the people out there have been very focused on. It was good to see the clinic finally lay out what the big plans are.
Yeah, there's another meeting July 10th, so this is not finished yet.
All right. You're listening to Today in Ohio. I should point out that Cliff Pinkard has published this spring's version of the Orange Barrel Report for all the ways your commute and driving around Cleveland is going to get interrupted in the interest of making the roads better so that they don't flatten your tires. I did hear from quite a few people yesterday about how their tires have been flattened by road hazards in Cleveland. It does seem to be a growing problem, but at least they're going to pave some roads and make it better. That's it for the Friday episode. Thanks, Lisa. Thanks, Laura. Thanks, Layla. Thank you for listening. We'll be back Monday talking about the news.